I am joined today, as you can see, by my colleagues, Judge Larson and Judge Johnson, and we are now ready to proceed with the second of three arguments on today's calendar. That case is Lance Arnold Kingbird versus State of Minnesota, case number A221642. Counsel, just a few words before we hear from you. I want to make sure first that you are able to see the clock on the screen. Can you both see that? You can just nod.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That clock will be counting down your time. And as you both know, appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have an opportunity to present a 5-minute rebuttal argument. We are recording the arguments this morning, and that recording will be available on our website shortly. To ensure the quality of that recording, I ask that you both identify yourselves and the party you're representing before you begin your arguments. And then I also ask you both to make sure that in your Zoom settings that you're on mute when you are not the person who is presenting argument. And I'd ask anyone who's observing today to also follow that rule and just make sure that you're on mute so that we don't have any audio interference. That concludes my remarks. We're now ready to hear from the attorneys, and we will begin with counsel for the appellant.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant Lance Kingbird. From Mr. Kingbird's perspective, the most important issue before the court is whether the district court abused its discretion when it held that Mr. Kingbird's claims were untimely and therefore there was no need for an evidentiary hearing in this recantation case. The Minnesota Supreme Court has made it abundantly clear that in cases of alleged witness recantations, that an evidentiary hearing is necessary to resolve the issue of witness credibility, and that such a hearing is necessary for resolution of the claim unless there is no chance the defendant can obtain relief. In order to reach the conclusion that no hearing was needed here, the district court did a couple of things. First, it said that Kingbird's claim was untimely because it was more than 2 years after his conviction became final, and he could not satisfy the newly discovered evidence exception to the time bar because, one, the recantation, even if taken at face value, did not prove innocence by clear and convincing evidence, and number two, that Kingbird didn't exercise due diligence in obtaining evidence of the recantation. The district court also said that no evidentiary hearing was needed because even taking the evidence presented at face value, Kingbird could not satisfy the Larison test, which requires that in cases of recantations that the outcome of the trial might have changed in the absence of the false testimony. In reaching these conclusions, the district court abused its discretion. If, as Mr. Kingbird contends, the record does not conclusively show that he is not entitled to relief, then this matter should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. So one of the first reasons why the district court concluded Kingbird could not satisfy the clear and convincing evidence prong of the newly discovered evidence test is because the complaining witness had not really recanted any trial testimony. I think that that conclusion upon which the district court based part of its denial requires ignoring that the complaining witness in paragraph 4 of a sworn affidavit said that the car and the couch incidents never occurred. I would also note that in the transcript of the interview with the investigator, she said the same thing on page 14 there regarding the car incident, the same thing on page 15 regarding the couch incident, and then again on page 20 reiterated that there was only one incident that had occurred here. And so I think that to deny on that basis, again, the district court just ignored the contents of the affidavit, which is contrary to the Minnesota Supreme Court's direction that prior to an evidentiary hearing, the contents of the affidavit should be accepted at face value. Another reason the district court said Kingbird couldn't satisfy that clear and convincing evidence prong was because the complaining witness only recanted as to that denying relief on that basis ignored that King Bird was convicted of three allegedly separate sexual assaults, and that providing any evidence that removed even one of those would make a significant change in this case. Because there were three separate offenses, King Bird's criminal history score was Hernandez. So he went from 156 months on count one to 234 months on count two to 360 months on count three. The complaining witness now says in an affidavit that two of those offenses that account for over 17 years of King Bird's sentence did not occur. That is a significant change in outcome for King Bird if the recantation is genuine. And I don't think there's anything in the time bar statute that says when a defendant is convicted of three allegedly separate crimes that he cannot obtain relief because he can only prove that three never happened. I think that the test should be applied to each individual conviction. And when that's done and it's viewed in relation to the couch and the car incident, that would mean that if the recantation is genuine, that King Bird could show the requisite change in outcome. Now, the district court also concluded that even if it took these recantations at face value, that there would still be enough evidence to convict King Bird such that the recantation doesn't show innocence here. And I want to be clear, what about what we think the evidence against King Bird is here. There is the complaining witness who testified, who was the only witness who asserted any firsthand knowledge of any of these events. There was not a single other witness who claimed any firsthand knowledge in this case who testified. Most of the witnesses who testified were called to repeat things that AL had allegedly said to them. But what that means is because there's only the one witness with alleged firsthand knowledge on this case, if we take away that person as the sole witness with firsthand knowledge, there is no evidence that any of these crimes ever occurred. And I do think it's really as simple as that as to whether or not a recantation, if genuine here, could show innocence.
Mr. Langsdorf, one of the cases that the state is relying on here to argue that the petition was untimely. So, you know, we're under the post-conviction statute sort of as a threshold matter, is that Onyelobi case where the Supreme Court seemed to make some distinction as to whether something constituted, a recantation constituted newly discovered evidence or given, whether the false testimony or lack of testimony in that case was known to the defendant at the time of trial. I assume you disagree that Onyelobi applies here, and I'm interested in hearing your rationale for that.
Yes, Your Honor, we do disagree that Onyelobi would be controlling in this case. And I think the most significant difference just factually is that Onyelobi involved a claim based on a statement by a co-defendant or an accomplice who said something along the lines of, Onyelobi was with me when I shot the victim, but she didn't know that I was going to do it, and we didn't have any plan to do it ahead of time. So there you've got a presumably friendly co-defendant who would provide evidence that the defendant didn't take part in the planning or perpetration of the crime. And I think the logic of saying that that evidence could have been obtained earlier through the exercise of due diligence holds up at least in theory, because if you've got a friendly co-defendant and a defendant who was at the scene of a crime and knew she didn't play any role, that the defendant could have, through the exercise of due diligence, gotten that evidence and presented it at trial. Now, if we contrast that with this case, we've got a prosecution witness against my client, and more importantly, we have the complaining witness. And I think under those circumstances, what is Mr. Kingbird's ability to get that information from the complaining witness? I think that trying to get evidence held by a friendly co-defendant is not apples to apples with trying to get evidence from the complaining witness in a criminal sexual conduct case.
Counsel,
and what we're
and maybe you don't know the answer, but I assume that there are some restrictions on your client's ability to actually contact the victim in this case, given what the nature of the conviction was. Is that true? Or do you know if there are any restrictions?
I am uncertain, Your Honor, as to what the current restrictions are on Mr. Kingbird and whether he would be able to have visits or contact this particular witness. And so I can't say for certain that he's unable or has an inability to contact this particular witness. But I think that the difference would be that in Onalobe, because the defendant was at the scene of a crime with a co-defendant and knew how the crime occurred and that there was another person who was a potential witness that could be in her favor, scenario where you have a single witness case like this, and that witness is also the complaining witness or the victim, there just isn't that same ability to get evidence of a recantation or evidence out of that particular person. And that's why I think that Onalobe wouldn't apply in these circumstances and wouldn't prevent this from being newly discovered evidence.
Mr. Longstar, I'm unclear about how this actually happened or you know, I mean I gather that the victim initiated contact of some type, but I'm not clear about when or how, and I'm not sure if that's in the record or if it's but and where in the record, but I mean, can you confirm for me? And I guess I'm specifically interested in whether if she did initiate contact, if she reached out before or after the 2-year time period had elapsed.
I'm not sure that we have it explicitly in the record how the initial contact occurred, Your Honor. It happened in May of last year. The complaining witness reached out to my client's sister and expressed an interest to speak with myself or an investigator. And from there, we had an investigator make contact with the witness, and then the investigator sat down, allowed the witness to make a statement as she saw fit on her time frame and at her discretion, and then it was presented to the court, I think, in August. So I think there was approximately 3 months total, roughly, in between the very first contact with the complaining witness where she reached out and when this was presented to the court. So it was definitely after the 2 years had expired.
I know that the interview occurred on a day in May of that year, but I guess I'm unclear about the first contact that led to the interview. And is that clear in the record?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I know that there was an affidavit. I can just tell you from what occurred that was within a week or two of when this first interview occurred, or the contact was very close in time to when the investigator first made contact with the complaining witness here. Now, in denying Mr. Kingbird's claim, the district court had concluded that there was sufficient other evidence aside from the complaining witness's testimony, which would show that Kingbird was guilty of these crimes, even if the recantations were genuine. But our view is that this witness or these other pieces of evidence do not on their own, without the complaining witness's testimony to give them context, show that any crime had ever occurred. One part of that is the DNA evidence here, which showed there was a mixture on the couch from which Kingbird and the complaining witness couldn't be excluded. But the DNA tech testified she didn't know how that got there or when that got there. And
well,
frankly, I don't think
Mr. Longstar, the complainant specifically recanted the incident that she had testified about at trial regarding the driving lesson. And based on my read of the record, there's no independent evidence to support that episode. Am I right about that?
That is correct. I think without the complaining witness's testimony, the jury wouldn't even know that a car exists in this case. And then as I was saying, as to the couch, there's an indication that there was a DNA mixture there, However, a person's DNA on their own couch in the house they live in, with both my client and the complaining witness did, doesn't show that any crime ever actually occurred without the complaining witness's testimony to give it context. And in this case, applying the Larison test to that recantation regarding the couch, we would have to take away that testimony, and then the existence of a mixture of DNA on the couch would not on its own show that any particular crime had occurred here. And the other piece of evidence is that there was a singular sperm cell that was obtained from the complaining witness's skin in this case. However, that sperm cell was not proven conclusively to be Kingbird's, and I don't think there was any testimony from anybody who said that it was matched to him through scientific means. And then there was also testimony of a complaining witness's physical examinations, but that testimony didn't show any obvious signs of injuries or other obvious signs that a sexual assault had occurred that would independently support the conclusion that any of these assaults had occurred without the complaining witness's testimony. And I think in a single witness case in which the affidavit or the complaining witness has now submitted an affidavit recanting two of the three alleged assaults, it is a pretty simple fact that with a single witness case, that if the complaining witness's testimony on its own is sufficient to get a conviction, that complaining witness's recantation, if genuine, is enough to show innocence by clear and convincing evidence. And because that is the case, the Supreme Court direction is that there needs to be an evidentiary hearing on the issue of the witness's credibility. And because that didn't occur.
Thank you for your argument. And next, we will hear from counsel for respondent. Mr. Frank, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Dave Frank, and I have the pleasure of representing the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in today's case. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it found that appellant's third post-conviction relief petition to be untimely, that the victim's alleged recantation did not bear sufficient indicia of trustworthiness to justify an evidentiary hearing, that the victim's affidavit and statement transcript really do not fit under the newly discovered evidence or interests of justice exception to an untimely post-conviction petition, nor did the court err when it concluded that the bulk of the petition was not labarred. In light of time issues today, I'd like to jump right into the issue of whether the appellant met his burden to get an evidentiary hearing based upon his petition, the victim's affidavit, and transcribed statement to the appellant's investigator. When it comes to a claim of witness recantation, the respondent is abundantly aware that the showing that the appellant must make in order to receive an evidentiary hearing is lower than what is required for showing of a new trial.
Counsel, I know it's probably screws up your argument order that you had planned, but I do really think that the time bar issue is particularly, I guess I have some questions about the time bar issue and like to make sure. So I wonder if you could maybe start with the time bar argument.
Certainly.
It seems dispositive of the case.
Okay. Judge Larson, there is a time bar. It's 2 years. It's statutory. It's 2 years from the date of the appellate review, which I have as July 18th, 2018, and it expired on that same date in 2020 by statute. I think the issue is, does this fit one of the exceptions? And the new evidence standard and the witness recantation standard overlap and lend themselves to some conflation, but they are both exceptions to the 2 year post-conviction petition time limit. And I think that they are best addressed as separate concepts, but I think Mr. Longsdorf is arguing that he fits an exception either under new evidence or under the Larison test for witness recantation. Under either circumstances, they are exceptions to an untimely petition. And that's my primary point. The court correctly concluded that this was an untimely petition. but did address the victim recantation because it's an exception to an untimely filed petition. Does that answer your questions, Judge?
Well, I think so the way I understand the argument in your brief is that the Onalobi case, which I'm very happy that Judge Gaetis had to pronounce it first before me, I worry that if we apply it to this situation, how would you ever survive the 2-year time bar if the main witness recants, if this is neither newly discovered evidence, and if this doesn't meet the due diligence requirement? Like what else would someone need to do, taking it out of the context of this case? But if you have a true witness recantation, how do you survive the 2-year time bar? Given that I don't think the purpose of the time limit is to wholly prevent innocent people from being able to petition for post-conviction relief.
Because I don't think the two-year time limit applies to the victim recantation exception. And I think that's the easiest way for me to explain that. If it's an exception to the 2-year time period, and if a defendant or an appellant can demonstrate that there's a true victim recantation, I don't think the 2-year time limit applies.
So if that's the case, why wouldn't that exception have applied here where there is a recantation from the victim, at least as to two of the three?
Well, Judge Gaetis, I disagree. My reading of the record is that there is no recantation. And to address your specific question, if appellant can establish that there is a true recantation, and if that recantation has indicia of trustworthiness, then it certainly would apply and can get beyond the 2-year bar.
Okay, so why isn't the affidavit and the statement to an investigator not a true recantation?
Judge Gaetis, I've identified 4 reasons as to why appellant's petition and supporting documents do not bear sufficient indicia of trustworthiness. They just can't be relied on for either reliability or trustworthiness based upon the nature of the case and the circumstances surrounding this alleged recantation. And the first reason is that the affidavit and statement transcripts do not amount to recantations. And I asked the court to specifically review the witness testimony of the victim here. The victim never states at trial or in the statement in the Family Advocacy Center, which is substantive evidence, that the sexual assault occurred in the car. Appellant takes great pains to establish that this assault occurred in the vehicle itself. That was never the testimony. The testimony from the witness, both at trial and in the Family Advocacy Center statement, is that the sexual assault occurred after the act of driving.
But didn't the statement that she subsequently gave specifically disavow that anything happened on that date, and didn't she specifically state that she made up that allegation?
Oh, I think that if the court is looking at it that way, I think the court is reading a lot into both her trial testimony as well as her statement that she provided to the investigator. In fact, the affidavit itself specifically refers to the act of driving. And when the court, I do want to make a point that the affidavit and the statement itself are really both being supplied. In fact, the affidavit refers to the statement and incorporates it. When the court reviews that statement, the investigator takes great pains to avoid talking about what happened after the driving incident and focuses on the driving incident itself, which occurred when the victim and the appellant dropped off victim's little brother And then they drove approximately a mile ahead of time with the victim being on the appellant's lap. After they drove about a mile away, the victim was directed out of the car by the appellant, and the appellant raped her in outside in the back of the car. I think facts are important here, and I think that that distinction is important. And when the court understands that—
So, Mr. Frank, I mean, I'm looking at the affidavit. She signed paragraph 4, says the incident on the road, that I testified about never happened. I mean, isn't that broad enough to encompass anything that happened while either in the car, out of the car, but, you know, while driving? I think it's referred to in other places as, you know, in the woods.
Right.
But that's a pretty broad statement. Why isn't that broad enough to encompass all of the trial evidence about that incident?
I would argue not, Judge Johnson, and that's because the appellant had the opportunity to expand that in the statement and conspicuously avoided that. Being on the road is far too broad for purposes of showing indicia of trustworthiness, particularly when we've got a 33-page statement that never addresses the sexual assault itself, but only the facts preceding the sexual assault.
Aren't the issues we're talking about things that would get decided in an evidentiary hearing? I mean, isn't that part of why we have evidentiary hearings for witness recantations is because you get affidavits from victims that might not go into all of the detail that's required to analyze these types of issues?
Again, Judge Larson, if there's a basis for trustworthiness in those underlying affidavits, the respondent submits and the district court agreed that there is not sufficient.
What would be trustworthy? I mean, here we have a statement to an investigator. We have an affidavit. This isn't like something written on a napkin somewhere by someone who may not be the victim. The court is not supposed to get in there and weigh the evidence and, you know, does indeed have to make some sort of threshold trustworthiness determination. What would have been more trustworthy, though?
I asked Judge Gatiss, I asked you to look at the Caldwell decision from 2014. What would be trustworthy is a specific recantation to specific trial testimony. That's what got the evidentiary hearing in the Caldwell case. Here, when you're conspicuously avoiding the sexual assault simply to address preceding facts before the sexual assault itself, that's not sufficient.
Here, one of the reasons the district court determined that the petition was untimely for the purpose of the newly discovered evidence exception to the post-conviction statute is that the complainant said that Mr. Kingbird sexually assaulted her on one occasion. So the district court said, well, you know, something happened on at least one occasion. Therefore, it doesn't really matter that she's now suggesting that nothing happened on these other two occasions. Do you agree with that reasoning of the district court?
I don't agree with that reasoning, Judge Agatis. There were three separate incidents resulting in three separate convictions. So if the court is reading the district court's rationale to include that, she's not recanting.
One moment. I'm going to interrupt you, Mr. Frank. We seem to have lost Judge Larson.
Oh.
And I just want to, if we could just stop the clock, sure. Marshall, I just want to halt the arguments until we get her back. Sure. So, Frank, you may continue.
Thank you. As to the incident on the couch, I think the statement is also important to because it contradicts statement in the two whether or not that couch incident occurred. In her statement, she does not retract that. She simply says she does not remember and only recalls at this time one incident that took place during the Super Bowl. So a witness who can't remember, that is not a recantation under Pippett. And I want the court to, that is contradictory information as it relates to the submission in the petition itself, which also—
Mr. Frank, could you point to which page of the transcript are you talking about? I'm looking at page 14 of the transcript where she makes a statement. I don't quite recall that, actually. It's near the bottom.
That is correct. It's actually in my brief, Judge Johnson, and that may be the easiest way for me to respond to the court's question.
But, you know, it's not clear to me that she's saying she doesn't recall the incident. It could be that she's referring to that she doesn't recall her testimony, which would have occurred nine, 10 years earlier when she was much younger. I mean, the immediately before that, the interviewer says, "I have copies of your testimony about that. I'll read what you said." And that's when she said, I don't quite recall that, actually. So I guess, how are you so sure that what she's saying there is she does not recall the incident on which one of the convictions was based?
Well, I'm certainly interpreting that, but I'm looking at her words. I don't recall that, actually. She goes on to state, yeah, the only time I can recall anything on the couch would be him. We were watching the Super Bowl. Again, she's saying I can't recall. She's not saying it doesn't happen. The respondent didn't have the burden here. The burden falls with the appellant to demonstrate that the petition bears sufficient indicia of trustworthiness. And I just don't think that it is met in either of these claims of a recantation. I also do want to address that that we agree with the district court's determination that appellant misinterprets the victim's statements as it relates to, I didn't tell the full truth. That certainly demonstrates that she didn't completely tell everything that happened, and she is referring, and I think the district court correctly determined that what the victim is referring to is the allegations regarding her mother. And that's one of the issues that the victim wanted to bring forth, is that I didn't bring up the situation with my mother. And the court correctly determined that that is because she was concerned about her mother going to jail as well for her participation in it. And that supports the district court's conclusion that when she's referring to not telling the truth, she's only referring to not telling the truth as it relates to her mother's participation. I see that I am out of time. I would simply refer the court to the balance of my brief as it relates to my other arguments.
Thank you very much for your argument and for your flexibility during your argument. Sure. We will go back to Mr. Longstorff now. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you may begin whenever you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to direct the court's attention regarding whether or not these are recantations. There's on page 14 of that transcript, I'm looking at about probably two-thirds of the way down right now. And in that, the complaining witness says that the event driving down the dirt road never happened, which I think is a direct contradiction and a direct recantation, which matches paragraph 4 of the affidavit that she submitted. And then just regarding the context of the couch incident, my understanding and take on that is that the witness is saying that that event never occurred on the couch, which I think is consistent with, if we look throughout this, the complaining witness says, hey, look, one incident occurred, the other two didn't. There's a lot of context about who put this person up to saying that these happened and why. But what I think they show is that this witness does not stand by the testimony regarding two of these claims. And if that is in fact the case and taking what was presented at face value, if it's true, then my client would get relief. And because that's the case, we need to have an evidentiary hearing to make these credibility determinations. And then the other thing that opposing counsel had argued was that there's insufficient indications of reliability here in order to justify a hearing. And I would just draw the court's attention to one of the cases in the respondent's brief, which is a Ferguson case, and it's the 2002 version of that case. And essentially what that Ferguson case says, and really the whole point of it, is that there needs to be something in the nature of a sworn statement to justify the trouble of having an evidentiary hearing. And what was at issue in the Ferguson case is they had submitted an unsworn investigator's report, and the Supreme Court said, well, that's not enough to justify a hearing. And then it went through a bunch of examples of cases where it said, well, look, these are things that are enough to justify a hearing. And in almost every one of those, it was either described as an affidavit or a sworn written statement. In this case, we've provided a sworn written statement that is from the complaining witness herself, and that on its own creates enough sufficient indication of reliability to justify an evidentiary hearing. And really everything that comes after that about, well, you know, it's not a good enough recantation, or, you know, or there might be a little conflict, needs to be decided after an evidentiary hearing. And really what the Supreme Court has said is that when you have a recantation, it comes down to witness credibility, and that's something that has to be determined after an evidentiary hearing. And Mr. Kingbird's burden here relative to the time bar and the newly discovered evidence exception to that is to allege the existence of newly discovered evidence that would prove innocence by clear and convincing evidence in order to be entitled to consideration of the petition under the newly discovered evidence exception. Taking that, which the Supreme Court had said in the Miles v. State case out of 2011, and applying it here, there is more than sufficient evidence here that if true, would prove innocence by clear and convincing evidence. And therefore, on its face, at least at this point, the evidence has satisfied the newly discovered evidence exception. And that puts us into the realm where this is a case that depends almost entirely on witness credibility, which has got to be determined after a hearing. And because the district court did not have that hearing before making those credibility determinations, it abused its discretion. And we would ask this court to reverse and remand for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. I thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within 90 days. That concludes the argument for the second of our three cases on a calendar this morning.